Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 420, side one, titled The Destabilization of California, Part 2. This is being recorded on August 11th of the year 2003. As I speak, obviously on August 11th, 2003, the state of California is in a state of confusion. We have been the focal point of a political and economic destabilization program that is quite the matter of record, although people do not read the record. And we're facing a situation which is as unfortunate, as dangerous, as proto-fascistic in some ways as it is utterly farcical. Writer Edith Wharton had a phrase that, quote, "A frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys." And contemporary California is a very, very good example of that. Before I get into the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you that sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. Their server has been down. Their archive server has been down, and it will be back in service, I'm told, relatively soon. But more recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, and older programs are available at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU site and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at SpitfireList.com. Spitfire is the CD and tape duplication service that has all of the various programs and lectures I've done over the years. And you can reach Spitfire by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Their email is mail, M-A-I-L, at SpitfireList.com. And visit their website, again, at SpitfireList.com. And in the For the Record section, in addition to the links to the WFMU websites, there are also detailed annotated descriptions of the programs. As I'm speaking, I'm somewhat behind in writing the descriptions. 416 should be up presently, and I'm working on 417, yea, verily, even as I speak, okay? All righty. The buzz here in California, obviously, is all about Der Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, somebody who has no political past as such. I'm going to be talking about Der Terminator next week. One of the things that is sort of interesting is to hear Arnold, who's saying all the right things, talking about how he's going to kick the special interests out of Sacramento. The irony not only of that statement, but the irony of the situation itself, in which Gray Davis, an uninspiring political figure by all accounts, but not a bad governor, not a glowingly good one, but a person who is not responsible for the things that are overtaking California, Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign is being managed by the former Republican governor of California, under whose administration the energy deregulation that led to the destabilization of California is the only way to put it. Pete Wilson, Pistol Pete Wilson, is Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign manager. And Arnold's going to kick out this special interest, huh? Not bloody likely. New York Times, August 11th, 2003. In full field, it's all about Schwarzenegger. It's by Charlie LaDuff and Alan Foyer, F-E-U-E-R. Skipping down, we read, "Admonished by his advisors not to make news out of the box, Mr. Schwarzenegger left his campaign chairman, Pete Wilson, the former California governor, to attack Mr. Davis as an incompetent spendthrift and lesser political minions to explain his personal finances to a press corps demanding details, any details." It'll be interesting to see just how much Schwarzenegger's situation gets scrutinized. He is not, of course, a politician. He is a movie actor and former bodybuilder, as bad a movie actor as he was a good bodybuilder. But he's not a politician, and himself has a very interesting family background. We'll talk about Schwarzenegger next week. What's worth noting is that Gray Davis, although not a particularly inspiring governor, is not a particularly bad governor, and the things for which he is being blamed are not his fault. California is the largest state in the union. It has been quite firmly Democratic since the years of Ronald Reagan and company, when it was a Republican bastion. And Karl Rove, Bush's brain and Machiavellian handler, has been the architect of the Schwarzenegger candidacy. And as we spoke about in For the Record program number 280, California itself has been the focal point of a deliberately arranged energy crisis that has basically resulted in the situation that Gray Davis is being blamed for. Just like the petroleum industry and George Bush's, that's the elder George Bush's CIA, helped to destabilize the Carter administration, as we spoke about in For the Record 214, by conspiring with the Saudis to, and other oil producers to basically drive up the price of gas, create a phony gas shortage, not only to destabilize Jimmy Carter, but to serve as a pretext for the military buildup that basically placed the United States deeply in debt. Bill Clinton began to reverse that situation, but now George Bush has escalated that enormously. The San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, July 23rd of 2003, had in their the Mature and Ross column about Schwarzenegger's possible candidacy. From what we hear, the Republican hierarchy, especially those close to former Governor Pete Wilson, would favor Schwarzenegger. At least that's the word that came out of the Bohemian Grove this past weekend, where a number of state and national GOPers, including presidential advisor Karl Rove, happened to have gathered at a club getaway. Well, Karl Rove basically is the president of the United States. Bush is, in effect, a little more than a figurehead. Rove makes the key decisions, and Rove is a very formidable figure and someone who is to be reckoned with and even feared. We're going to supplement For the Record program number 280. Again, the title of 280 was A Nation of Sheep Will Beget a Government of Wolves. That a quote from the late Edward R. Murrow. And we're going to go into the energy company's deliberate destabilization of California. In particular, we're going to be taking a look at Enron. And by the way, if this sounds overly conspiratorial, this is now a matter of public record. What we're going to be looking at in the paper that will comprise the vast bulk of this broadcast is, first of all, an energy commission that was chaired, well, not first of all, but at the foundation of the Bush administration, an energy commission that was put together by former petroleum executive Dick Cheney, who has been overseeing energy policy for former petroleum executive George W. Bush, and in turn, there was a report put together by elder George Bush Secretary of State James Baker's law firm of Baker and Botts, which is not only representing Prince Sultan, one of the defendants in a trillion-dollar lawsuit that has stemmed from September 11th, but Baker Botts is also the counsel for the Carlyle Group, one of a number of business enterprises that join the Bush and Bin Laden families. We're going to be taking a look at Enron. We're going to be taking a look at the Baker-Botts Energy, the Baker-Botts Energy Report, which made repeated references to the California, quote, energy crisis, unquote, as a justification for its extremely energy-friendly energy recommendations or energy policy recommendations. We're also going to take a look at the Cheney Commission's apparent reliance on the Baker-Botts report. And one of the things that this particular author, a woman named Catherine Eureka, and I may be mispronouncing that, Y-U-R-I-C-A, has pointed out, that in addition to the economic policies that appear to have stemmed from the Baker-Botts report, the foreign policy, to a certain extent, which was realized with the war in Iraq, was also, to a certain extent, an outgrowth of some of the policies that were recommended not only by the Baker-Botts report, but also by a paper that we're not going to be dealing with in this program, but that we have dealt with in the past, namely the Commission for a New American Century, or the Project for a New American Century, which on pages 51 and 67 of their report lamented that a military buildup or a military revision would not be possible unless there was a catalyzing event such as a new Pearl Harbor. Of course, coincidentally, something like that did happen on September 11th. I'm being sarcastic when I use the term coincidental. September 11th is an incredibly complicated event. It is far more than simply a domestic political event or a provocation. But that's rather like the three blind men holding the elephant. If one grabbed one part of the elephant, that's what it would look like. But it's much, much broader than a mere provocation. One should not make the mistake of assuming that the entire world is an American conspiracy and that basically we can do anything we want. There were a lot of players in that, including what I refer to as the Underground Reich. And September 11th is not going to work to the benefit of the United States. Not by a damn sight. If there is not a serious reversal of policy, the economic policies that will be the result of September 11th, combined with the foreign policy, which is at this point projecting American power into far-flung parts of the world, that is going to bankrupt and ultimately destroy the United States economically and lead to its political and or physical destruction or subjugation. The paper that's going to comprise the bulk of tonight's broadcast, or today's broadcast, is titled Fraud Traced to the White House, subtitled How California's Energy Scam Was Inextricably Linked to a War for Oil Scheme. This is authored by Catherine Eureka, K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, and last name capital Y-U-R-I-C-A. It's available on the World Wide Web. And research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. And the first part of the article here talks about a very interesting foreshadowing, I guess one could say, or perhaps dry run, of the huge electricity price increases, which basically have resulted in a 300% increase in the cost of electricity for consumers and for business. This has been the main thing that has led to Gray Davis's extreme unpopularity. That combined with the fact that the state is in bad shape economically, like every other state in the union. The states are in the worst fiscal shape they've been in since the Great Depression. That obviously due to the downturn in the economy. And in the case of California, the energy deregulation, which was effected under the administration of Pete Wilson, a Republican governor who is now managing Arnold Schwarzenegger's Republican campaign to unseat Gray Davis. The first part of Fraud Traced to the White House by Catherine Eureka reads as follows. This story begins with the California energy crisis, which started in 2000 and continued through the early months of 2001 when electricity prices spiked to their highest levels. Prices went from $12 per megawatt hour in 1998 to $200 in December of 2000 to $250 in January of 2001, and at times a megawatt cost $1,000. One event occurred earlier. On July 13, 1998, employees of one of the two power marketing centers in California watched incredulously as the wholesale price of $1 a megawatt hour spiked to $9,999, stayed at that price for 4 hours, then dropped to a penny. Someone was testing the system to find the limits of market exploitation. This incident was the earliest indication that the people and the state could become victims of fraud. The Sacramento Bee broke the story 3 years later on May 6, 2001. Today, Californians are still paying the costs of the debacle, while, according to state officials, the power companies who manipulated the energy markets reaped more than $7.5 billion in unfair profits. During those early months of the Bush administration, and even during the prior transition period, Dick Cheney was deeply involved in gathering information for a national energy policy. The intelligence he gathered would provide justification for a war against Iraq, but would also place White House footprints all over a fraud scam. This is how it all happened. That Ken Lay, the former chairman of Enron, enjoyed a long and close relationship with the George Bush Sr. is a well-known fact. What isn't so well known is that George W. Bush also benefited from a close relationship with Lay. No one supported the younger Bush quite like Lay. Enron executives contributed more than $2 million to George W. Bush's political campaign since 1999, earning Lay an open door to the governor's office. Lay was also Bush's number one choice for Treasury Secretary. A study authorized by Representative Henry Waxman reveals that Enron had 112 known contacts with the Bush administration in 2001. This figure does not include 73 disclosed contacts between former Army Secretary Thomas White and his former colleagues at Enron. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld recently fired White. By the way, I would note that there are many, many connections between this administration and the Republican Party and Enron. The outgoing chairman of the Republican National Committee, Mark Rasko, is a former lobbyist for Enron. Many of the people in this administration held stock in Enron. The national energy policy that enabled Enron to reap some of its ill-gotten gains was formulated under the elder George Bush, and the younger George Bush actually was in business with an Enron subsidiary since 1986. Those are just some of the contacts here. And as we've looked at in our visit with John Loftus in For the Record 406, and also in For the Record 370, Enron appears to have been one of the main vehicles for allowing the, allowing the events of September 11th to proceed forward. Enron was brokering the Afghan pipeline deal, and Cheney was hoping that, according to John Loftus, that this would help to bail Enron out. This was known to Mohammed Atef, the chief of operations for al-Qaeda, and apparently the al-Qaeda infrastructure, which obviously was being hosted by the Taliban in Afghanistan, figured that the ongoing connections between the administration or the negotiations between the administration and the Taliban would keep the federal authorities off of al-Qaeda to a sufficient extent to permit September 11th to go forward. And that we discussed in For the Record program number 406, our visit with John Loftus. We also talked about that in For the Record program number 362 as well. You can visit John Loftus's website at john-loftus.com. Going back now to the article, Fraud Traced to the White House by Catherine Eureka. Significantly, Ken Lay was also a close friend to Dick Cheney, who was a former Enron shareholder. It should come to no one's surprise that given the relationships, Ken Lay was selected to work on the Bush Energy Transition Team under the chairmanship of Cheney. Lay's easiest assignment? He interviewed potential candidates for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, an agency that would oversee his company, and months later lead a long, slow investigation into Enron's role in the California energy debacle. The president also picked Lay's nominee, Pat Wood, to serve as chairman of the agency. Ken Lay was a very useful and a very knowledgeable man to have around. He knew, for instance, of the holes in the California power market that could be exploited. He tried to warn officials about the problem in 1994 when Enron testified at a Public Utility Commission hearing. Unfortunately, his advice was ignored. Enron then went with the flow. It reversed itself, endorsed the system, and lauded the politicians for setting up what Enron knew was an exploitable and faulty infrastructure. As events would unfold, the dark side of Enron got its comeuppance when the Justice Department began investigations of Enron's role in the California energy disaster. Along with Dynegy and with other power brokering companies, Enron employees were subject to federal criminal charges. One Enron employee pleaded guilty to wire fraud, while Dynegy agreed to pay $5 million in fines. The next section of the report deals with the recommendations that the next section of this paper deal with some of the recommendations on which Cheney basically based his energy policy. In April of 2001, Ken Lay handed Dick Cheney a two-page memorandum recommending national energy policy changes. The memo contained Enron's positions on specific, rather technical issues, which were presented as a, quote, fix, unquote, for the California crisis. Enron brazenly advised the administration not to place price caps on energy, which would be precisely the request California officials made to the president, and which the president and the vice president would just as brazenly deny until public pressure forced them to capitulate. According to a report prepared for Representative Henry A. Waxman, over 17 energy policies recommended by Enron made their way into the official White House National Energy Policy Report. Congress awoke from its somnambulism, having become alarmed at Enron's close association with the Bush administration. Congressional committees asked Dick Cheney for the names of those who advised him and the reports he relied upon in drafting the nation's energy policy. Cheney bluntly and adamantly refused to reveal those facts. After months of standoff, the General Accounting Office, or GAO, filed a suit against the vice president in an effort to obtain the requested information. The White House then developed a fascinating legal strategy that helped them triumph over the legislative branch. Defense attorneys from the Civil Division of the Justice Department should have been assigned to the case. However, in an unprecedented move, the Bush administration required the services of the nation's number one gun, Theodore Olson, the Solicitor General, who normally only makes appearances before the Supreme Court. Olson, his assistant Solicitor General, and a hand-picked group of Justice Department lawyers formed a special trial defense task force, unquote, to defend the vice president. This act telegraphed to the court, press, and public that this was no ordinary case. The move paid off, a federal judge found for Mr. Cheney, and the GAO declined to file an appeal. That, more or less, marked the end of the story, but then something happened. On October 6, 2002, a newspaper in the United Kingdom published a little-known article about Mr. Cheney's advisors. According to Neil McKay, an award-winning journalist writing for Scotland's Sunday Herald, Dick Cheney commissioned an energy report from ex-Secretary of State James Baker III. The time of this commission, unquote, is not reported, but since the members of the appointed task force held three video conferences and teleconferences in December, January, and February of 2001, Cheney therefore logically contacted Baker sometime prior to the December 2000 meeting during the presidential transition period. James Baker was uniquely situated to fulfill Cheney's commission, for among the many hats he wears, he is legal counsel to the Carlyle Group, one of the nation's largest defense investment firms, whose board consists of former high-level government officials, including George Bush, Sr. By the way, the Carlyle Group also had a considerable investment from the Bin Laden family, officially reported at only $2 million, but unofficially verified as being considerably higher than that. Other Saudi figures implicated in the allegations concerning September 11th, including Khalid bin Mahfouz, are also associated with the Carlyle Group. The elder George Bush was at the annual investor conference of the Carlyle Group on September 11th, 2001, in Washington, D.C., along with members of the Bin Laden family. The elder George Bush then left by plane before all flights were grounded. That sort of inconvenience did not, however, affect members of the Bin Laden family, a number of members of which were flown out of the United States on September 12th before they could be questioned by the FBI. Whatever the possible guilt of those members of the family, that constitutes obstruction of justice by George Bush, because it is now quite certain that Osama bin Laden wasn't the lone nut of his family, but there were other members of the bin Laden family implicated in the funding of al-Qaeda. Going back to the Baker Commission, so to speak, or the recommendations coming from Baker Botts, his law firm, Baker was also the hired gun, unquote, for George W. Bush's campaign in Florida, along with Karl Rove. But among the hats he wears, none is more valuable than his ability to become invisible and leave no fingerprints behind. James Baker courts the press and is hailed as a statesman. He also serves as the honorary chairman of the James Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, a think tank that was involved in aiding the George W. Bush presidential transition teams. Equally intriguing is the fact that Baker has ties to both the Bushes and Ken Lay. Years earlier, in 1993, after Baker stepped down from his stint as Secretary of State, he and Robert A. Mosbacher, Bush's senior Bush Senior's Commerce Secretary, signed a joint consulting and investing agreement with Enron. The two men began a lucrative career making joint global investments with Enron on natural gas projects. Baker Botts LLC, James Baker's law firm, flourished in its specialty of international oil and gas counseling. Since Baker walked in their circles, when he set out to select an energy team to advise the White House, he filled it with leaders of the oil, gas, and power industries. Three appointees stand out. Kenneth Lay from Enron, who was working on the Bush Energy Transition Team under Dick Cheney at the time. Chuck Watson, the then chairman and CEO of Houston's Dynegy Incorporated. And Dynegy's general counsel and secretary, Kenneth Randolph. Both firms were deeply involved in illegally manipulating the California energy market at the time and eventually faced criminal investigations. By the way, again, note that as I speak on August 11th of 2003, the recall vote, which threatens Gray Davis's second administration, he was just reelected last fall, is basically the result of the budgetary mess that California is in, in addition to the fact that in addition to the fact that all states are in serious economic shape because of the economic downturn, California is in particularly bad shape, specifically because of the policies of Ronald Reagan, Freudian slip, of Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign manager, former Governor Pete Wilson, under whose administration these policies were put into effect, and the energy policy that was being quite deliberately manipulated by the corporations that are associated with the Bush administration. Going back to the task force, Dick Cheney's energy task force, the oil men selected for the task force were Luis Justi, a Shell non-executive director, formerly CEO of Petróleos de Venezuela, S.A., John Manzoni, regional president of British Petroleum, David O'Reilly, chief executive of Chevron Texaco, and Stephen L. Miller, board chairman, CEO, and president of Shell Oil. In his Sunday Herald article, Neil McKay links another fellow of the Baker Institute to the document, Sheikh Saud al-Nasser al-Sabah, the former Kuwaiti oil minister. The Baker Institute's report on energy was funded through Khalid al-Turki and the Arthur Ross Foundation. Sometimes a mystery is hidden in a loaded detail that most of us would rather skip over. A case in point is this. The Baker Task Force report shows a 41-member task force, but the press release gives 51 as the number. This, of course, could just be a typo, but when we look at the structure as revealed in the report, it shows the Baker Energy Task Force team was divided into three separate groups. First came the names of the 41 all-star task force. Secondly, came the names of 9 observers. And thirdly, there was an unknown number forming a group of reviewers, unquote, whose identities were not disclosed, but who collectively had, quote, broad academic, economic, and energy expertise, unquote. According to the acknowledgments, these individuals reviewed drafts of the report at various stages and participated in the task force meetings, unquote. Perhaps the most telling admission is that the final version was greatly enhanced, unquote, by this shadowy group. We're going to pursue the relationship between the Baker Group, between Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force, between Bush-friendly energy companies like Enron and Dynegy, which deliberately jacked up the price of power due to the regulations that have been implemented under Pete Wilson, Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign manager, and which are the chief factor which basically helped to exacerbate California's budget crisis. All states are having budget crises, and in particular, this has been the focal point of voter dissatisfaction with Gray Davis, an uninspiring figure, but not a bad governor or a bad person, someone who, however, is the focal point of a deliberate energy destabilization policy. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 420, The Destabilization of California, Part 2, being recorded on August 11th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.